From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a debut novel about an 8-year-old hemophiliac boy and his abusive father. We talk with Atlanta novelist and playwright Jim Grimsley about Winter Birds. It tells the story of his life growing up in a poor and violent family in the rural South. Also, You're Okay, It's Just a Bruise. Terry Gross talks with sports doctor Rob Huizinga about his 7 years as team physician to the Los Angeles Raiders. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the latest release by Tom Petty. All that coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. President Clinton signed the legislation today that approves U.S. participation in the GATT World Trade Agreement. Later today, the president leaves for a 34-nation trade summit in Miami. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton plans to use the Summit of the Americas meeting in Miami to push for agreement on a huge free trade area among all the democracies in the Western Hemisphere. The 3-day summit will include leaders from 34 nations from North and South America. Only Cuba is not part of the group. No formal trade agreement will be adopted, but Trade Representative Mickey Cantor said the United States hopes to get agreement on a target date for ending trade barriers in the region. The Summit of the Americas is just the latest in a series of trade meetings and agreements for the president. He fought hard to win passage of legislation for 2 trade treaties, the North America Free Trade Agreement and GATT, a worldwide trade treaty. Mr. Clinton recently attended an Asian trade summit where leaders of countries with borders on the Pacific Ocean agreed to work toward eliminating trade barriers by the year 2020. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
Administration officials confirm that President Clinton has offered to send American ground troops to Bosnia to help evacuate UN peacekeepers. A senior defense official says the U.S. could send as many as 15,000 soldiers. The official says the U.S. plans to provide more than half of the rescue force. But UN officials say they have not made a final decision to withdraw the peacekeepers. A UN spokeswoman says rebel Serbs have allowed an emergency food convoy to move toward Bihać, where peacekeepers and civilians have not been supplied in 2 months, and Serbs are besieging the town. The convoy had been held up for several hours in the Krajina region of Croatia by Serbian militiamen. Hundreds of Cubans have escaped from a refugee camp in Panama after 2 days of riots. Tomas Cabal reports from Panama City.
Hundreds of Cuban rafters have escaped from one of the 4 refugee camps maintained by the United States Southern Command in the vicinity of the Panama Canal. At least 1,000 American military units have been engaged in trying to quell the disturbance. Infantry troops, Air Force security personnel, and military policemen have been called in an effort to recapture the escapees who have fled to jungle areas that surround the camps. According to a U.S. military spokesman, the rioting broke out after 121 Cuban citizens were transferred to the United States and Spain from Howard Air Force Base. According to Brigadier General Jim Wilson, commander of Operation Safe Haven, the protests are a result of the false perception by the Cuban refugees that the parole process and the procedures for movement to third countries and the United States was being purposely slowed down by Safe Haven personnel. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Cabal in Panama City.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 54 points just before the close. The Nasdaq Composite Index was down 15 points. This is NPR. A law enforcement official says a man may have opened fire with a semi-automatic rifle outside the White House in October because he saw someone in front of the building who resembled President Clinton. The official, who asked not to be identified, says investigators believe the gunman saw a gray-haired man who looked something like the president and who was taking a private tour. The suspect in the shooting, Francisco Duran, is scheduled for trial in March on 15 felony counts, including attempted assassination. No one was injured in the incident. A federal grand jury added 4 weapons counts to the indictment today. A spokesman for the prosecutors say the new charges have nothing to do with the reports of the possible mistaken identity. After 3 days of debate, Israel's cabinet has reaffirmed its commitment to the peace process with the Palestinians, including a redeployment of Israeli troops in the occupied West Bank. NPR's Paul Miller has more from Jerusalem.
A government statement said Israel will honor its commitment to the agreement signed with the PLO. It also said Israel would act according to lessons learned so far. And statements from ministers indicated that while Israel will redeploy its troops in the occupied West Bank, it may not make the full withdrawal from Palestinian population centers the Palestinians are expecting. Israel is concerned about the safety of settlers in the West Bank and the Palestinian Authority's failure to stop attacks against Israelis. But the cabinet reaffirmation may help shore up the peace process 2 days before Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, Foreign Minister Shimon Peres, and PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat collect their Nobel Peace Prizes for the agreement. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
Belgium's defense minister, Leo Delcroix, resigned under pressure today, but is denying charges that he built a villa in southern France with public money. Delcroix is the fourth government official forced out of office this year in Belgium. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. It would be hard to exaggerate the tragic circumstances of Jim Grimsley's life. He grew up in a desperately poor family in the rural South. His father was an alcoholic wife beater. Grimsley and his youngest brother were both hemophiliacs. Jim Grimsley has written a novel based on his troubled childhood. It's called Winter Birds. Grimsley is also a playwright now in residence at the Seven Stages Theater in Atlanta. The novel tells the story of an 8-year-old hemophiliac named Danny and his experiences on a snowy Thanksgiving day when his father brutalizes the family during a drunken rampage. Danny is a dreamy kid who often escapes from the poverty and violence of his life by hiding in his own special place by the river. Here's Jim Grimsley reading from Winter Birds.
You think the pines must like the quiet, the same way God likes quiet in church. So you tiptoe through the underbrush. Under your breath you sing, "Shall we gather at the river?" Breaking off the tip of a branch as you always do when you pass a low tree or bush. The beautiful, beautiful river. Stripping the leaves off the stems, tearing them to pieces and dropping the pieces to the ground. You love the way the bits of leaves fall, the air under them so solid it knocks them from side to side. But soon you stop your wandering and walk directly to the river, not caring how much noise your feet make in the beds of cold, stiffened leaves. You have a place you always go, a certain clearing beside a train trestle that you found the first day your family moved to this house. You like the place because the branches overhead are thin and sunlight, on a clear day, falls through them making nets of shadow on the ground. Today, same as every other day, something in you lifts as you enter the clearing. You jump over a fallen log, imagining Mama warning you to be careful. Don't fall on something and get yourself hurt. You sing the song louder. Shall we gather at the river? The beautiful, beautiful river. To the nearest tree, you say, "Tree, now you better warn me if my papa comes so I have plenty of time to hide." The wind off the cold river cuts through you, and you squeeze your thin coat tight. You gaze at the surface of the river, leaves spinning downstream like music box dolls. Honeysuckle grows thick as a mattress on the bank, and you lie on it looking up at the sky. This is what you came here for, to lie like this, to watch the clouds for a while and then to count. 1, 2, 3, shut things away, shut away the house and the flat fields, shut away Mama, Papa, Amy Kay, Alan, Duck, Grove, shut them away. You are an orphan. You live in these woods away from them all, away from the whole world. Your family is dead. Shut them away. You close your eyes. You have come to the river to dream. A dream whose shadows move against your lids.
Your book tells the story of one especially violent night in a violent family's history. It's Thanksgiving mm-hmm. night. Yeah. And I'm thinking that your own father was an alcoholic and would rampage around the house when he was drunk. You tell a story about one night in your family when your mother called the sheriff in for help. Maybe you could tell us what happened.
Well, the syndrome in where I grew up in a very rural part of North Carolina in a town of about 400 people. There were no major cities around us. And so in terms of law enforcement, you had the sheriff and the deputy sheriff, both of whom were friends of my father's. neither of whom particularly liked being waked up at the hours when my father would generally go on one of these rampages, and neither of whom wanted to take him, you know, the 20 or 30 miles to the jail to cool off. So basically what would happen when we called, we usually didn't call the sheriff because, frankly, he was usually drunker than my father. We would call the deputy, who was a very nice man who had no children of his own and, you know, was real well acquainted with the situation in my household. So he would come over, sit with my dad for a while. The minute the sheriff would come in, my father would become totally calm and sober and benevolent and switch totally from what he'd just been, this violent, drunken thing raging in the house. And the deputy would sit down and they'd talk for a while, and usually the deputy would take him away to a motel room rather than take him to jail. And within a couple of hours, he'd be back at the house doing the same things again.
In one story that you tell, you describe the deputy taking your father away, three blocks away, to spend the night in the motel. And then your mother stayed up, afraid that he would come back. Did he come back?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a true story. He came back that night and set fire to the house with all of us asleep in it. It was... He worked in delivery of propane gas and was a electrician, so he knew a lot about houses. He knew how to. He basically caused a fire to start near a propane gas tank at the back of the house, and Mom, who was not asleep, luckily heard the sounds and smelled the smoke as soon as it started to come into the house, and then saw him leaving. So now we were never able to get anybody to believe that he'd actually done that, but we all knew that he'd done it.
Jim Grimsley is my guest. His novel is called Winter Birds. As a child, did you feel guilty because of your hemophilia? That if you and your brother had been born completely healthy, maybe none of this violence would have happened?
No, I don't think we ever felt like that, because the violence was so clearly from my father and from something in him that really didn't have very much to do with us. And frankly, his violence wasn't directed against the children nearly as much as it was my mother. It was his special torture was reserved for her, even if it was about the children. I mean, it was what he wanted always was to have her to blame for his problems, no matter how little the problems had to do with him. I mean, my father lost his arm in a farming accident when I was about 6 months old. My mother was miles away from him at the time, and yet for years and years and years, he accused her of being at fault for him losing his arm. I mean, he needed my mother in some strange, almost spiritual way to be his scapegoat for everything that went wrong in his life. It was, and that we knew, that we understand, because it was so clear. I mean, he was the kind of man who would come home and pick a fight with her for, you know, not drinking out of his tea glass when he wanted her to. I mean, the fights were so absurd that you knew they came from something else. And Mom was very, very clear about explaining this stuff in totally unemotional terms. I mean, she didn't pretend that he loved her and that he was trying his best. She told us what he was actually doing. And that, you know, I guess that was sort of scary at times as a kid, but I think in retrospect it was much better for us all. We understood what we were up against. We didn't blame ourselves for it. We knew we were living with a crazy man.
Did he ever, as the father does in your book, cause an injury that made you bleed?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, it was pretty much like in the book, it was inadvertent. He was very careful not to strike my brother or me because he knew how much that would cost him in terms of money. He also, like I said, he wasn't someone who beat the kids up. He beat his wife up. And I think that's also a common difference. It's very rarely the children who come in. It's either the children or the wife usually who come in for the abuse in my experience. But I was afraid of my father, but not afraid that he would hit me, which is curious. But we were, I guess when you have hemophilia, I mean, we learned to think of ourselves as pretty much untouchable. Nobody ever hit me or my brother. Even in the middle of this violent situation, nobody ever hit either one of us.
I've heard other artists who live with disease describe the way in which the disease inhabits their imagination. And they say that, for instance, a facet of the sickness will call up vivid images that they live with through their mm-hmm. art. How would you describe how your hemophilia informs your imagination and your writing?
Well, there's so many ways. Hemophilia taught me stillness when I was a child, and it was a very important lesson for me to learn. When you're bleeding in a joint, it's very painful to move it at all. And so there were weeks and weeks when I was growing up when I wouldn't be able to walk or to move. And learning how to live with that in a positive way rather than fight it the way my youngest brother did taught me a lot about living in general. That, and again, it goes back to that, the lessons that my mother taught me by telling the truth. I mean, what she taught me was that this was a fact. It wouldn't go away no matter how much I wanted it to. And I was willing to hear that lesson and to learn it. And so I began reading books and living in books and figuring out ways to be a boy and to be a kid without having to play baseball and roughhousing and doing things that I simply wasn't able to do, and you know, right down to the point of not ever going barefoot, which is, you know, in the rural South for a kid from a poor family to wear shoes during the summertime was fairly unheard of, but I, you know, that's something I had to do. I didn't let myself go barefoot outside until I was in my 20s, and those are big things when you're 8 or 9, and people around you don't have to think about them, but you do. But I saw the consequences of that in my own brother's life, in that he didn't do what I did. He didn't accept hemophilia as a condition that he couldn't change. He kept waiting for it to go away. You know, when he would get well from one bleed, he would go out and play with my brother who didn't have hemophilia. And they would roughhouse and do all the things that I didn't let myself do. And as a consequence, he had a lot more problems with his hemophilia than I did.
I think what makes your book so powerful, all stories of domestic abuse leave you with this overwhelming sense that there's no safe haven in mm-hmm. the world. There's no safety at home. And for a child, that's everything. Yeah. But you had the character in your book, and you had hemophilia on top of this, which means, as you say, you can't walk outside without shoes on. You're always looking for a shard of glass. There really is no safe haven anywhere.
There's no safety even in your own body, I think. Then, I truly had a remarkable family, given what we had to go through. I mean, we were great practical jokers. We told jokes all the time. We have a set of the wickedest senses of humor that I've ever run into in human beings. And I think in a lot of ways, I mean, I hate to sound like a broken record, but my mother was just remarkable. And so we survived. And I think that's, for me, when I read this book and compare it to other novels that are about abuse, is that that's what seems remarkable to me, is that I actually do feel safe thinking about this book. I think Danny is safe in a very peculiar way. He's made safe by his mother and by his own strength. And I think that's very important.
My guest is Jim Grimsley. He's the writer in residence at the Seven Stages Theater in Atlanta, and he's just published his first novel. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Jim Grimsley is my guest. His novel is called Winter Birds. I get the impression you were very close with your mother.
Yeah,
and
very.
That part of that closeness, and I'm guessing here, involved that you were the one who asked her the hard questions about her past and your family.
Yeah, yeah. There was some way in which my mother and I could talk always that I don't think she shared as much then, especially with my sisters and my brother. She and my sister had a difficult time when my sister was a teenager, I mean, as mothers and daughters do. So at a time when Mom was really finally understanding her need to get away from my father, she was reaching out to talk to me about these problems in a very tender and friendly way. And I think I was, in some ways, I was her first friend at a time in her life when she needed friends very badly.
When you're a friend of your parent, it's hard to also be their child.
Yeah.
Did you always feel that, was that your experience, that you were trying to be the adult, trying to shield your mother?
Not so much that, because my mother was very good at enduring and protecting herself. I mean, well, I guess the true answer to that question is, if I think back to how I felt when I was a teenager, yes, I felt very protective of my mother. I think, again, she was always very clearly the mother. She was always very nurturing, and she took care of me, especially when I was sick, very well. But there was always the sense, and it's sort of hard to talk about this, but I gave up on her being my mother in the recognizable ways because of the violence in the family, and I gave that up fairly early, I think. I think that's one of the reasons I could accept the friendship with my mother. I mean, it was clear that my mother could take care of me to a certain extent, but also that she couldn't really protect me. And so in some ways, I think that led to a very basic distrust that's probably still there. I mean, we have a very close relationship, my mom and I, but it isn't, you know, I do have trouble accepting certain kinds of care from her or from anybody else. I mean, I'm rabidly independent, and I don't want to be under anybody else's thumb, including hers.
It's interesting when you talk about your mother that you say both that she protected you as a child and provided safety, a safe haven for you, but you also say that ultimately there's distrust there and she couldn't protect you.
Yeah.
Is this the ultimate paradox of...
I think so, yeah. I think the truth is that what my mother taught me was that there are limits to what any person can do to protect another person. I mean, you know, you hear these stories about mothers who are prepared to lay down their lives for their children, but, you know, I think there's a certain fallacy. You know, I could not have expected my mother to lay down her life for me in opposition to my father. There were certain kinds of protection that were denied her that she simply wasn't strong enough to provide. And that's what I'm really trying to talk about. We had the kinds of safety and security that my mother was never able to get for herself when she was a child. We had food on the table. We had a place to sleep. We had a warm house. Those are very basic things that she didn't have. But she couldn't, in order to get those things, she had to endure the treatment that my father visited upon her. I mean, that's the best way that I can say it. We were physically safe and physically fed and taken care of because she made this bargain. She made a marriage with this man who beat her up. And even when she knew that's what she had to face by staying with him, she stayed. That was the lesson of my childhood, is that no one, no matter how much they love you, even if they claim to love you unconditionally, really does. I mean, my mother, as much as she loved me, had to make sure that she survived the night with my father. And if that ended up costing me something in the process, that was really no more than she was already paying herself. So I think that's the answer.
Your father committed suicide after spending some time in mental institutions. And
right.
Your youngest brother, who was a hemophiliac too, also committed suicide. And I realize this is an unfair question. I'm asking you to simplify what must be tremendously complex in your family. But how do you describe the connection, or how do you draw the connection between the two deaths?
My father, for all of his violence and for all of his meanness, was not a bad person. He was not somebody who set out to be the way he was. He wasn't someone who enjoyed it. It tortured him very much. And any time I felt differently, I would just reflect on the fact that he'd lost his arm, that, you know, that for the last 20 years, you know, I never knew him with two arms, so I didn't know what he was like before. Mom did, and she said that there was a drastic change in him when that accident happened. So I guess the way that the deaths are connected for me is that I blame in some ways my brother's death on my father and on the way that my family grew up to a very great degree, much more so than I blame my father for almost anything. Because of all the kids that he had, he was closest to my youngest brother and was far more loving to my youngest brother than he was to any of the rest of us. And I think in some ways that wrecked my brother. I think my brother felt a deep connection with my father in himself and felt as if he shared my father's diseases, his schizophrenia and his alcoholism in particular. And in that sense, I think there was that connection between the two things. And in some ways, the child that my father touched the most deeply was the one that he endangered the most deeply.
So have you ultimately forgiven your father and was writing this book? Was that a kind of absolution for you or a purging? Did it help you forgive
him? Oh, it was a great purging, yeah. It was not therapy. I mean, it was much, much more complicated than that. Because I've, you know, as much as this is my own story, the fact of the other side of it that's mine is the writing side of it. I mean, I have wanted to write fiction, to write, to make words into art for as long as I can remember, so that I was always... That was equally important to me in the writing of Winter Birds as was the telling of this very compelling story. No, I haven't forgiven my father. I don't need to forgive him. I mean, that's the business of whatever higher power there is. I don't love him. I didn't love him when he was alive. I don't feel any need to achieve some kind of peace with him. He did terrible things to me. He did terrible things to my family. And even if he were alive, I don't think I would be able to deal with him because of that. So that's the answer. No, I don't forgive him. What he did was wrong.
Jim Grimsley is writer in residence at Seven Stages Theater in Atlanta. His novel is Winter Birds. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Rob Huizenga was the team doctor for the NFL's Los Angeles Raiders, but he resigned in a dispute over the players' medical care. Huizenga often found himself at odds with team owners who wanted to keep injured players in the game, and with players who couldn't see the long-term consequences of steroid and other drug use. Coming up, we talk with Rob Huizenga. His new book is You're Okay, It's Just a Bruise. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Wildflowers, Tom Petty's latest release. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. President Clinton signed the GATT World Trade Agreement today. Under the pact, the United States joins 123 other nations in the most sweeping trade agreement in history. The president said that with GATT, the United States can lead in the 21st century.
We must never run away from the world. We must go into the 21st century convinced that the only way to preserve the American dream is to be involved with the rest of the world, to be willing to compete, to be determined to win, to be serious about overcoming our problems, but to realize that the only way you can ever do it is to seize the opportunities that are plainly there.
The president leaves later today for Miami and the Summit of the Americas, where he hopes to get Latin American nations to endorse the goal of a free trade zone for the Western Hemisphere. U.S. military officials in Panama say 60 soldiers have been injured and about 1,000 Cubans have fled a refugee camp after riots today and yesterday. A base spokesman says the Cubans attacked soldiers with stones and tore down a barbed wire fence around the camp. He says the injuries suffered by American troops are limited to minor cuts and bruises. The Cubans being detained in Panama are refugees who were picked up trying to float to the U.S. aboard rafts. Nearly 9,000 refugees are housed in camps near the Panama Canal. The mushroom cloud stamp will not be printed after all. And the Postal Service announced today that it will not depict the atomic bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima when it commemorates the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II next year. NPR's Melinda Pankava reports.
Postmaster General Marvin Runyon said today he was abandoning the controversial stamp design because the president asked him to. Runyon also cited the importance of U.S. relations with the Japanese. Japan and the State Department had objected to using the image of the mushroom cloud created when the U.S. bombed the Japanese cities and killed tens of thousands of civilians. Until today, the Postal Service resisted the pressure to change, citing the feelings of U.S. veterans who fought in the Pacific. But even the pilot of the plane that dropped the bomb on Nagasaki called the mushroom cloud artwork too heavy-handed. In its place, the Postal Service says it will use an image of President Harry Truman preparing to announce the end of World War II. I'm Melinda Pankava in Washington.
Yasser Arafat has repeated his claim that Jerusalem will become the capital of a Palestinian state. Arafat made the vow at a rally marking the 7th anniversary of the Palestinian uprising. Israel says it will never allow Jerusalem to be divided again. Arafat is leaving tomorrow for Oslo, Norway, to receive the Nobel Peace Prize that he's sharing with Israeli leaders. On Wall Street, stocks closed sharply lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 50 points to close at 3685.73. This is NPR News. A federal grand jury has added four new charges to the indictment against Francisco Duran, who was charged with shooting at the White House in October. The grand jury had already charged Duran with attempted assassination and several other counts. The Justice Department announced today that the panel is adding the carrying and use of firearms to earlier assault charges. A law enforcement official said today that the gunman may have mistaken a visitor taking a private tour of the White House for President Clinton. If prosecutors can support that allegation, it would lend credence to the accusation that the gunman meant to harm the president and not just fire randomly at the White House. Eight men have pleaded guilty to blowing up a waterfall on Arizona's Salt River. It's a popular rafting route protected as a national wilderness. NPR's Philip Davis has the story.
The eight men are all from Phoenix, and one has experience with explosives, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. They all pleaded guilty to blowing up Quartzsite Falls on the Salt River, which used to form some of the most challenging rapids in the Southwest. Officials didn't release a motive for the crime, but some river runners speculated the men, all of whom were rafters, might have thought the rapids were too challenging. On five occasions between August and October of last year, they admitted to detonating nearly 200 pounds of powerful binary explosives underneath the falls. The explosions turned what was once a dangerous Class 6 rapids into an easily navigated stretch of river. The eight men face up to 10 years in jail and $250,000 in fines. This is Philip Davis in Washington.
San Francisco Giants baseball player Daryl Strawberry has been indicted on charges of trying to evade paying income taxes. He's accused of failing to report more than $500,000 in income. And the Associated Press reports the National Hockey League has canceled next month's All-Star game because of the labor dispute. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air.
I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're featuring an interview Terry did earlier this week. At a baseball game, you can hear the crack of the bat. But at a football game, the crack you'd be most likely to hear is a bone. But broken bones are just one of the hazards of the sport. For 7 years, from 1983 to 1990, Dr. Rob Huizenga was team internist for the Los Angeles Raiders. He took care of any internal injuries, head injuries, lacerations, and infections. He also helped players be more aware of their overall health, working with them on everything from overcoming jet lag to improving their diets. Huizenga is a former president of the National Football League Physicians Association. Now he teaches medicine at UCLA. He's written a new book about his experiences in the NFL. It's called You're Okay, It's Just a Bruise. Terry asked Dr. Huizenga what a typical halftime was like for him.
Well, halftimes were mass units. You know, we'd have players that were dehydrated, that you were pumping in fluids, you know, essentially not like putting in IVs in an emergency room, but essentially more like, you know, changing a tire in 10 seconds at the Indianapolis 500. We'd have players that had cuts and scratches, often need to suture players. Of course, there would be a whole sundry of various orthopedic, you know, knee, shoulder bangs. And occasionally, obviously, we'd have people that were dinged in the head and would have to do several neurologic exams. One halftime I always like to refer to was, you know, a particularly brutal halftime we had once in Chicago where they had this horrendous turf where I think people really forgot to change the there's a rug underneath artificial turf, and this half was especially notable. But you know, I always tell people that was one game where you could give a medical score, and basically it was the Raiders at halftime: 3 concussions, 1 blown out knee, 1 blown up thumb, 1 chin laceration, 2 lost teeth, 1 displaced filling, and about 2 square yards of forearm skin, you know, lost to that artificial turf. Versus Chicago in that particular game, 1 bruised foot, a twisted elbow, and one urgent hospitalization for a lacerated kidney noted when their quarterback, Jim McMahon, couldn't stop urinating blood at halftime.
Wow. So I guess the artificial turf is pretty bad for players and for doctors.
I think it is. You know, there's only really been one study. This is something that football buffs go over time and time again. Only one real good scientific study, and it did show that on pass players, the running backs don't get more injuries, but the linemen do. And on running plays, the running backs seem to get more injuries. And I don't think it takes a government grant to figure out that if you're going to get plummeled straight backward and you're a quarterback, your brain's going to prefer, you know, going into sod over cement. But, you know, it's a money issue. You know, we can put grass in every stadium. It's a question of, you know, it costs more when you get the rock concert in, when you get the motocross racing and whatnot. And, you know, I think it comes right down to, you know, how many, you know, knee operations and maybe artificial knees down the line are you willing to sacrifice for how much extra money to the stadium operator?
My guest is Dr. Rob Huizenga, and he was the doctor for the Raiders. He now teaches at UCLA and is the author of the new book, You're Okay, It's Just a Bruise. You write that there's a fuzzy boundary between good medicine and good team doctoring. What's a typical situation where those two are at odds?
Well, as the team doctor, you're paid for by an owner that has purchased a club possibly for $200 million and is paying $34 million plus in salaries. And many of these people are incredibly successful businessmen, and they start to view the team as a product. So many widgets or or paper clips that they're going to have to maneuver somehow to turn a profit. And the only way to turn a profit is to get your players, specifically the better players, out on the field constantly. So there are many, many pressures that the team doctor feels. The pressures can be as minor as, you know, let's be part of the team, that rah-rah, all-for-one experience, which sometimes can get the doctor carried away subconsciously in emotion, to owners specifically going up to doctors and saying, you're not tough enough, or owners specifically going up to players and requesting they take pain-killing shots in ankles and knees, which may potentially pose a long-term health benefit to them, or owners essentially implying to both players and doctors that if they don't play tough, if they don't play with injuries, they may not be with the club anymore.
Were there pressures on you as the team doctor to send back into the game injured players?
Well, again, there were pressures, and again, those are difficult to enumerate, but in our situation specifically, there was a team orthopedist who was very close to the owner who was sending in players. For instance, we had a safety who got in a collision and fractured his larynx, the voice box, you know, that protrudes in the mid-neck. This is an injury that can prove extremely serious. If all of a sudden you get swelling or bleeding in that injury, it can put pressure on your windpipe and occlude breathing, and obviously that can be fatal. This particular player, you know, I evaluated, said, you're out of here, and started taking him back to the locker room to do various things and to get in a position that if we needed to emergently stick tubes in to assist his breathing, if it did get plugged up, that would go. When we assessed that everything was stable and I just had him sitting on the sideline and went away to do other things, the orthopedic surgeon said, you're okay to go in. And of course, the players are so hepped up and juiced up that, you know, they will do, you know, whatever. And they're dying to get into the game and prove how tough they are, for better or worse. And so, you know, I pretty much had to go out and tackle this person to bring him back. That's the sort of everyday conflicts that I ran into.
What kinds of pills were the players taking when you got to the team?
Well, when I got to the team in the early 80s, again, I didn't see much use of recreational drugs, cocaine, marijuana, narcotics, compared to the use that you would expect in a similarly aged group right out of college. Actually, the use was quite low in these athletes. What I did see was a high use of vocational drugs, things that were necessary for them to stay in professional sports and earn a paycheck during that brief flickering career. And those substances, obviously anabolic steroids, later, of course, much that was hid from me, like growth hormone, I found out more use of that than I had initially suspected. And, of course, amphetamines, which are widely used in many sports, especially baseball, but certainly also in football. And these substances, again, anabolic steroids were perfectly legal, and the players that were using them tended to be getting prescriptions from doctors outside the club. And it, in the instance of Lyle Alzado, which, of course, has gotten the most press, you know, I would go to an athlete like Lyle and say, in his specific instance, Lyle, this is the worst-looking cholesterol I've ever seen in my life. What are you doing to yourself? You've got blood in the urine. You know, and I told him, when I run out on the field, I don't know if you're having a heart attack or you pulled a muscle. I mean, your cholesterol is that worrisome. And he would scream and yell and say, I've got these steroid-prescribing doctors, and they tell me my body's handling it just fine. Now, what are you going to tell a player? What he's doing is perfectly legal. All you can do, like your patients that smoke cigarettes, is counsel them against doing them.
My guest is Dr. Rob Huizenga, and he is the former doctor for the Los Angeles Raiders, and he's written a new book about that period of his life called You're Okay, It's Just a Bruise, A Doctor's Sideline Secrets About Pro Football's Most Outrageous Team. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Rob Huizenga, and he's a former doctor for the Los Angeles Raiders and the former head of the NFL Physicians Association. When you were with the Raiders, did you find that a lot of players tried to fake their way through medical exams, either through lying about their medical history so that they'd so that you wouldn't try to keep them off the field, or faking their urine tests when drug testing came into play?
Well, you see a little of everything. The first time I was exposed to this experience was when we go down to the combine. Every team doctor from all the 28 teams, both the orthopedists and the internists, go down and evaluate the top 300 prospects out of college. And I was shocked. Every person coming down the line denied any past medical problem. And it struck me, you know, my whole life I had been in a situation where people are paying money to come see the doctor and they have a list of complaints. Here, it was something totally different. It was detective medicine. They would tell you everything was fine in every body system, and it was your job to try to figure out, did they abuse drugs? Did they really have, you know, a heart condition that would lower their ability to be someone that would contribute to a football team? And it was really sad that you put a doctor in a position to be an adversary to someone. And I had never even thought of that. And, of course, that same philosophy continues on in the team, where the doctor could be in a position to make the athlete get a lot less money on the next contract if you find out that they're somehow medically flawed. And so then they withhold this medical information, and that may prove deleterious to their long-term health as well. And that's also something that I want to make sure that doctors aren't put in a position to be the adversary for the players, because that also isn't right.
How do you get around that?
Well, I think that you need a independent doctor. You can't have a doctor for the owner. In other words, how would you like it if you're working for that radio station and they appoint me as your doctor and I'm getting paid by the radio station? So you come to me with a terrible case of laryngitis and say, should I do my show or not? And I say, well, of course you should do your show. Now, you look at me and now who is calling the shots? Is it the guy that's paying my bill, or do I really have your best interests at heart? And it's an untenable position, not only when you look at that inherent conflict of interest, but also the pressure and the emotion involved in sport today, and specifically in professional football. So you've got to make the doctor independent. You got to take him out from under the thumb of the team owner.
You were the head of the NFL Physicians Association, and you write at the end of the book that now the NFL Physicians Association is trying to work against private hospitals who want to contract with the NFL. What kind of deals do the private hospitals want?
Well, if you can believe it, and this is really what it's come down to, as you well know, modern medicine today, we had the advent of these for-profit hospital chains that go out and try to do whatever it takes to get the right PR to get more patients. Well, obviously, it's a nice feather in your cap to be the team hospital and then to appoint your doctors to be the doctors for a professional franchise. And as it turns out, there are two new franchises, one in Florida and one in Charlotte, North Carolina, who, believe it or not, basically, the club said, hey, you want to be the team hospital, you want to be the team doctors, well, how much are you willing to pay? And the bidding in the Florida team definitely got up to $1 million. So imagine the plight now of the poor player. You're stuck in a position where the team, you know, this huge multi-billion-dollar team monopoly of football, now jumps in bed with this multi-billion-dollar medical hospital chain, and they're both kind of seeking profits. Where the heck do you think the poor player, you know, his medical needs are going to come when you have that type of financial union?
You left the NFL over medical disagreements. Do you miss professional sports?
Well, absolutely. I'm somebody that has a tremendous personal interest in sports, both from a personal and a research level. And I think that when I left, I'll be honest, you know, it was upsetting. You know, I felt that I had done everything in the player's best interest. And then to have to leave because, you know, I wouldn't play a player that was hurt. And it just was upsetting. And then to have the owner, again, when I was unable to say anything because all of the reasons why I left were patient-doctor confidentiality, and before the various players allowed me to say what I said in the book, for them to come out in Sports Illustrated and say that they had fired me, it really did get my gall that these multi-billion-dollar people think they can just push people around like so many pawns on a chessboard, and that the fans will just keep coming if the team wins and there's no personal accountability. I will say that upset me.
What rules and equipment changes do you think could be made pretty easily that would make football a safer sport, but still an exciting sport to watch?
Well, the first thing that we need to do is we need to get more information. We need to find out really what the risks are in turf, multiple concussions, you know, and other collisions, and excuse me, the peculiarities of weight gain and the exact effects of all these drugs that players feel they need to take vocationally, from steroids to growth hormone to amphetamines, and of course, you know, the effect of these numbing shots. Knowledge is the basis for making any recommendation, and we're sorely missing in that, and the NFL is blocking appropriate research. So that's number one. Number two is you have to have a mechanism where this research, if it is done, can be parlayed into rules changes. You ask what could be done right now. Well, there's obviously common sense things. I saw instances where, say, Jim Plunkett, who was a star quarterback for the Raiders, was picked up, thrown violently on his shoulder, which was an obvious illegal play. What happened was the San Francisco 49ers were penalized 15 yards, and Jim Plunkett had surgery on his shoulder and was out for the rest of his career, essentially. So it doesn't make any sense to have a 15-yard penalty versus something like that. The player that does that certainly should be out of action as long as the player that he's injured on an illegal hit. That's number one. Number two, it's absurd that we have a system where a rushing defensive player gets one free step after a quarterback has released the ball. Imagine the most vulnerable position. You've just thrown a ball. Your arm's extended. You're leaning forward. You have no defenses. And then you have a 325-pound individual that's barreling at you, that hits you at full speed and knocks you as hard as they can, in many instances, off AstroTurf, which is essentially concrete. That makes no sense. Many other sports, that's absolutely outlawed. And that's a common sense sort of thing. In the old days, they didn't even have to have a rule, because all the rushing linemen, there was a sportsmanship thing. They would ease up and, if necessary, grab the quarterback so that he wouldn't fall down. Now, many of the coaches, or certainly the players, feel that you knock out these key players and you can win the game. And so there really, I believe, is much more of an intent to injure now. And so, unfortunately, we have to legislate very tightly to try to protect athletes who are in a position, a bodily position, where they are unable to protect themselves.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Rob Huizenga is the former internist for the Los Angeles Raiders. He's the author of the new book, You're Okay, It's Just a Bruise. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Linda Wertheimer joins us to talk about what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, the U.S. is sending troops to Bosnia. What do you have on that story?
We'll have a report from the Pentagon, and we'll try to talk to some administration officials about what it means. The troops are being sent to rescue and to help remove UN troops. And, of course, then there's the question of what NATO and the United States does once those UN troops are out of Bosnia and no longer in danger. Also, we'll have a report from Panama, where Cubans have escaped from detention and caused a riot. We have a report from Elizabeth Arnold that Democratic dander is up in the first days of Republican rule, and a report that only 1% of back surgery is necessary.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Wildflowers is being marketed as Tom Petty's second solo album, but it sounds a lot like the music he played during 20 years with his band, The Heartbreakers. Rock critic Ken Tucker considers whether the consistency of Petty's music is a weakness or a strength.
You belong among the wildflowers. The hours, you belong somewhere, you feel free.
In many ways, Tom Petty's Wildflowers is a product of the rock and roll industry so predictable and conservative that it seems an object designed to be despised. In 1994, what could be more trite than a Tom Petty collection that features a few of his old bandmates from the Heartbreakers, plus a bunch of familiar Los Angeles session players like percussionist Lenny Castro, as well as super special guest star Ringo Starr? What could be more expected than Petty's solemn croak of a voice enunciating lyrics as pretty as a hotel bedroom painting? And yet, why does all this continue to sound so good? There, in that utterly typical yet irresistibly catchy song, are a few clues to Tom Petty's continuing appeal. There's the couplet, "Let's get to the point, let's roll another joint." Well, for many of Tom Petty's fans, the joint is the point. They use Petty's loping melodies as their relaxation of choice. Then there's the title line, "You Don't Know How It Feels," which is completed in the chorus as, "You don't know how it feels to be me." But of course we know how it feels. How it feels to be Tom Petty is how it feels to be oneself. Tom Petty has the gift of being a big rock star able to eternally reduce himself to the status of his lowliest listener without seeming condescending. And his fans love him for it. By now, it's almost hard to remember that when he first came along in the late 70s, Petty sounded like a guy who had copied his singing style from Bob Dylan and liked to emulate Everly Brothers melodies. This did not make him look like a hip fellow in the wake of punk rock. But he's persisted with an admirable steadfastness that's ended up making a virtue of predictability. All of which is to say, this is a really good album.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Tom Petty's new album, Wildflowers. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Nancy Updike and Alan Tu. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogain.
Come on, go with me, babe. Come on, go with me, girl. Baby, let's go to the cabin down below.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Nelson Peary tells us about his travels through America as a hobo during the Depression and about serving in the segregated army with other black men during World War II. Peary is the author of the memoir Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.